This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest today is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 17th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
And we are talking today about the opera La Finta Giardiniera by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And this is the craziest story ever.
Absolutely. Both the conductor and the director said this is a crazy story, but it is a remarkable opera in spite of it. I mean, opera has some silly plots, and this is the ultimate silly plot, which means you really don't need to know the storyline with this opera. And Mozart is about glorious music, actually. You just need to listen to the music, and with a great production, it's perfectly clear on stage what's going on. So you have to buy a ticket and go and see, right?
Yeah, or, you know, buy a ticket and go and see it. And when you don't quite understand all the plot twists, you just sit back and receive the spectacle.
Exactly, because I think we can spend a lot of time, Mary Charlotte, sort of intellectualizing what is the story about. Some of these heavy-duty dramas, you do need to know what's going on and who's related to whom, because sort of things like incest can slip in like Salome without our noticing, and it's good to know what's going on then. But with a piece like this with comedy, you really don't want to be distracted from what's going on the stage. I mean, the super titles are there. Our titles, as you know, are on the back of the seat in front of you, so you have it in the language in which it's sung, and in English, you can follow that way. But if you're using your mind to read the text, you're not as open to the music, and the music should be telling you everything that's going on. And in this case, that's the case. You don't need to worry. Just sit back and enjoy it.
One thing that I thought was so interesting, I mean, I read the, and I want to read this part from Opera Unveiled, and also, I mean, we talk every year about the fact that you write this book, Opera Unveiled. It's now in its 17th year. It has five chapters, one on each of the operas. And you write a hilarious little description of each character, mm-hmm. which I would like to read aloud at some point.
Okay.
But it was funny because, I mean, okay, I'll read it right now. But mm-hmm. Sandrina, here's the seven leading singers in La Finta Giardiniera. Sandrina, the pretend gardener, which is what La Finta Giardiniera means, who is really the Duchess Violante. She loves Count Belfiore, a bounder who once loved the Duchess but who now loves Arminda. Podesta is the mayor of the town who loves Sandrina and thinks she's a gardener. Arminda, his niece, engaged to and in love with the Count. Ramiro, a poet, who loves Arminda, but she has left him for the Count. Serpetta, the maid, who loves the mayor. And Nardo, who is really Roberto, a servant to Sandrina, but who is currently a fellow gardener helping his mistress, and he loves Serpetta.
Yeah, see, clear as mud.
There will not be a quiz. But here's what I thought was funny was Mozart wrote this when he was 18, and which I didn't realize until later, and as I was reading, I was like, oh my goodness, this is so high school. But he was 18.
Yeah, I don't think that's actually the way to describe it. This is something sort of he was assigned. In those days, especially if you were a young composer, you didn't have the luxury of deciding what pieces you would write at this time. It was a little bit, I was thinking today, you know, people say, why do they use the same stories over and over again? I mean, where's the originality in that? If you think about it like pantomime, like Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk, or Beauty and the Beast, any of those, we know that story. I mean, we totally accept that we know the story. So we go to see how it's going to be redone, reinterpreted. That's sort of what's happening here with the classical style in a more musical vein. I mean, Romeo and Juliet, there's two productions out there now, Gounod's and one called I Capulete e Montecchi, the Capulets and the Montagues. So we know those stories. Shakespeare is still being reinvented, represented. So we don't question the stories. What we do look for is characterization and the way it's going to be done. And that's what Mozart did. He was sort of assigned this, and he just took it. And not only that, but he also inherited a style, a classical style, which was structured. most of his early operas, I mean, early, he was 18 when he did this, but it was his ninth opera.
Yeah, early Mozart like, what, 10 years old?
Yeah, he started 10 or 12 with the very first pieces. But when he had to write an opera seria, which was the more traditional style, he was absolutely locked in as to how it was going to be written. There'd be a recitative, an aria for the prima donna, then the seconda donna. And there were all sorts of rows if the seconda donna got a couple more measures than the prima donna. I mean, he really had to deal with all that nonsense. So it was very structured. With the opera buffa, which I suppose this is more buffa than seria. It's more about characterization, not who has how many notes. I mean, the whole hierarchy of the singers is not so important. It's about character. So in this particular piece, he does something which, even though working within the structure of the style, is really very unique, because some of the characters are broad buffo. There's broad comedy and parody and caricature in this piece. But some of the characters are seria. Now, he does two things with them. He presents them in a straight way where they're really singing of how their heart is breaking, and it's very genuine. It's exactly, there's no parody in that. Other times, another character will be singing of love in a heartbroken way, and you know he's sending them up. So there's a lot of subtleties that Mozart somehow got away with in those days because of his brilliance. I'd like to read, actually, first a little review of Mozart by a contemporary of his that was written a couple of weeks after the premiere. This man, Christian Friedrich Daniel Schubart, Schubert, wrote, "I also heard an opera buffa by that wonderful genius called Mozart. It's entitled La Finta Giardiniera. There are occasional flashes of genius, but it is not yet to the quiet, calm altar fire which ascends to heaven in clouds of incense. If Mozart is not a plant forced in the greenhouse, he is sure to become one of the greatest composers who has ever lived." Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
So this writer had seen the potential here of what was going on with Mozart at the time. So there are a number of styles as we go through these characters. As we said, you're telling the story today is going to be difficult.
Yeah, forget about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you gave us good indication. People can go back to the podcast or whatever if they really want to unravel it. Better still go to the opera and see for yourself.
Yeah. Now, but we're going to play excerpts because that's what we do, and it's really fun. And Podestà has an aria early in the opera.
Yes, Podestà is the mayor. This whole piece is set in his home, and the opera is actually set in the 18th century. So it's a very gorgeous palazzo, a stately home, a mansion. And an amazing thing has been done with this set. As you enter the theater and see upstage, you'll see the interior of this house, and it looks as if it's the real thing, but it's actually a printing photographic technique that has been used not only on the paintings and the whole backdrop of this, but on the costumes, on the furnishings, on the curtains, on tablecloths. It's a very interesting technique. So you see the inside of the palazzo, and that sort of flows into green lawns, because this opera is about the conflict of reason and no reason. So the green gardens of that period that were perfectly manicured represented law and order. But that flows then into the forest, and the forest is a place of the unknown, of the wild, of where people can be free, because at this time, there was a lot of pretension. In fact, the very title of this piece, La Finta, forget the giardiniera for a moment, it means what is real, what is false, or pretend. It's not just a pretend gardener. What is false? Because they're all wearing masks. And the opening piece, all the leading characters come downstage all singing about how happy they are. And they're not happy at all. They've all got all sorts of things going on. And the wrong people are loving the wrong people for the wrong reasons. That all comes out when one by one they tell us, the audience, how they're truly feeling, and they're not happy. So it's a time of masks. The balls of that period, of course, reflect that. They'd have these amazing masked balls when sometimes servants would go in masks dressed as duchesses and vice versa, and they could get away with all sorts of nonsense doing that. So this is sort of the setting of the piece. piece. Already it's a sort of it's an affected piece where it's hard to get at the truth. But this Podesta, he's the mayor, and he's sort of, I suppose, one of the anchoring points in the piece, who has fallen for, I wouldn't say fallen for, since in those days, if one of the hierarchy decided they wanted a girl who worked for them, it was a fait accompli. She didn't have much to say. In this case, he's set his eye on Sandrina, who is his very attractive young gardener, a woman gardener, which is interesting too. Not only is she the gardener, but he doesn't know it. She is a countess or a duchess or a marchioness. How she's called all sorts of different things. She's a member of the aristocracy, the duchess. So in this, he's singing, again, it's a sort of a send-up of a buffo aria. He sings about how he's attracted to her and how it makes him feel good, and he compares his feelings to instruments in the orchestra. And as each instrument is mentioned, they play their little piece. And then when he has dark thoughts, maybe it's not going to work, he hears bad sounds. So this is what he's singing in this little aria. In my breast I hear a sweet sound of flutes and oboes. What joy, what contentment, I am faint with delight, there's no greater pleasure. But, O God, suddenly the harmony changes and makes my heart beat faster. Viols enter and their gloomy melody disquiets me. Then there's a great noise, the timpani, trumpets, bassoons and double bass plunge me into despair. Let's hear a little of that. So that is Podestà, the mayor's, one of his little arias from La Finta Giardiniera. The recording I'm using today is a beautiful recording conducted by Nicholas Harnoncourt. Thomas Moser is Podestà, you just heard. Editha Grobevrova is Sandrina. Uwe Heilmann is the Count. Charlotte Margiono Arminda and Monica Bacelli is Ramiro, which would appear to be a male role. It was originally written for a castrato at the time of Mozart, so since they are not about these days, we have a mezzo-soprano sings that role.
And sometimes that's great, and sometimes it's just so weird.
It's part of the convention,
yeah,
of that those operas. I mean, it went right through to Richard Strauss, who in Rosenkavalier, the Knight of the Silver Rose, is a mezzo-soprano role, which is always a surprise. It carried through that late. It was very common in these days to make the castrato role into a mezzo, and sometimes now, of course, a countertenor will take on those roles, certainly in the Baroque, the very earlier operas, not so much here.
Countertenor being men who are able to sing in an incredibly high register.
Yes, soprano range,
yeah.
And on up.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about the history of the performance of this opera is that there are a couple of different ways that it's been done. One is that the kind of in-between sections called recitatives,
mm-hmm.
And ladies and gentlemen, it took me a while to figure out that the etymology of recitative is to recite.
Conversation,
yeah,
yes.
So speaking. Uh-huh. So sometimes those sections are sung and sometimes they're spoken.
In the classical time, they were pretty well, they were sung, but with very minimal accompaniment, just chords. That's all you would get. As time went on, there'd be more accompagnato, there'd be more of the orchestra accompanying the recitative, but at this stage, just chords. And these are the sort of the conversational bits that move the plot along, that tell you story, and they are the lead-in, the required lead-in at the time, into the aria, which is where everything starts. Up still, and the singer sings about what they are feeling at the time. It's about emotion, and that's when you sit back and you listen to the beauty of that voice. How well are they or are they not handling this aria? And at the end of the aria, they just walk off stage. It's ridiculous. We call them exit arias, you know. It's another convention you have to be aware of. So they walk off and somebody else comes on, sings another recitative and an aria, and so it goes on. It's interesting the way this works. But we should talk a little bit about the version we're doing here. Let me tell you what Santa Fe's chief conductor, Harry Bickett, said. I contacted him when I came to write this chapter for Opera Unveiled, and this is what he said. He said, the versions of La Finta are quite a thorny issue, since there are two distinct sources. The German Singspiel, which is the spoken dialogue, as you said, and the Italian recitative, which is minimally accompanied. The Santa Fe edition will be something of a hybrid. We use the original Italian recitative from the original 1775, but the orchestral material is the later, called the Namast edition. This is the version which had expanded orchestration. There's much discussion amongst musicologists as to whether this expanded orchestration is by Mozart or a contemporary, but in my opinion, it is so skillful and well-crafted, it doesn't matter. Tim Aubrey, the director who produced this opera for Welsh National Opera, and I have come up with a version that's faithful to the structure of the piece, with its big set-piece opera buffa finales, but also lean enough not to outstay its welcome. These pieces could really go on. And what had happened was that the original that Mozart wrote only had three performances, for whatever reason, the time of year it played. And then there was a German impresario who wanted to use it as a German Singspiel, where they used the spoken dialogue. So Mozart agreed to that, and that was the version then that was played. And then they lost the original. So for a couple of hundred years, people have been working with the German version until the 1970s, when in some obscure library in Czechoslovakia, the original showed up.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that amazing? After all this time. So then, the debate between directors and conductors is, which version are we going to use? And this is something that Harry Bickett has worked very closely with the director on. So we will get, apparently more of the conversational bits. As time went on, because it was a longer piece, people tended to chop out the conversation. So the plot gets even worse. You don't know what's going on. We've brought some of that back. And I love this, conductor Bickett says. He says, I have always loved this piece precisely because it is like a glimpse into the portal of what Mozart would achieve later in life. All the ingredients are in place, but he hasn't yet managed to distill his hyperactive imagination into the genius of The Marriage of Figaro, where there isn't a single redundant gesture or idea. Instead, one hears this 18-year-old wunderkind throwing caution to the wind and running amok with such joy and unfettered confidence. I love that. That's a great tribute. And that, I think, is how you should think of approaching this opera, not as early Mozart. You know, he's still learning. No, he's doing amazing things in this piece musically that make it very rich, and it will ring all sorts of bells. And I'm going to mention some of these as we go through early versions of how the Countess would sound in The Marriage of Figaro, and those wonderful women that Mozart so believed in, the servants who were teachers to their superiors and who generally resolved the plot. Think of Figaro. I mean, Figaro is really running the show for the Count, his master. His master's not happy about that. And of course, all that led to the French Revolution in the political sense. And eventually that all got straightened out where there were no longer counts and masters. So it's interesting, Mozart prefigures a lot of what was to come not so long after these operas were written.
Both musically and socially.
Yes, both musically and socially. He was in a sort of a bind himself because as a child prodigy, Mozart had been trotted around the courts of Europe by his father, who taught him and his sister. His sister was also extraordinarily gifted. But they were young children, and they would bring him to the kings and queens, the emperors, and they'd put, you know, cloth over his hands and have him play extraordinary pieces of music. And he was treated as one of the nobility in that case. But then he went through this awkward teenage style, time, if you like, which I suppose all teenagers do. So he stopped being a child prodigy because he's no longer a child. He has to get a job. So he becomes a servant in the court of the Archbishop of Salzburg, who had, of course, an orchestra, as they all did in those days. And the Archbishop treated him really abysmally. He was seated at table below the cooks. That's a little like, he never said anything about that, but this was a fact. And this was for a young man who had sat on Marie Antoinette's lap and thrown his arms around her as a child and told her, "When I grow up, I'm going to marry you." I mean, that's a true story. It was Marie Antoinette. The point of all this is that he understood both sides of this drama. And I think in the character of Sandrina, the Duchess in disguise, he is both looking at her as a servant who is sort of at the mercy of her master, Podesta, the mayor, and as the Duchess she really is, which of course comes out in the course of the plot, and what that dilemma is, and she suddenly has to face this. Mozart does this so wonderfully with his women. He always takes the side of women at a time where this was not typically the case. They were stereotyped and set as sort of second-class citizens, which I know you don't agree with.
Shall we hear an aria?
Yeah, we should. Let's go on to the next one. I chose this one because it's, again, a humorous one. It's from Nardo, who is the bass. He is Sandrina's servant, of course. And here he's talking about the infidelity of women, how difficult women are. And again, this is sort of tongue-in-cheek. He sings it fairly seriously, but listen to the words. He says, "Iron is subdued by the hammer's force. Marble can be worked by the chisel's force. But a woman's heart cannot be kept in check, cannot be persuaded by iron or a hammer or by an unhappy love." So he's having a little, you know, tongue-in-cheek poke at this whole serious broken-heartedness in the buffa style.
A forza di martelli, il ferro si a forza di scartelli, il marmo si lavora, si lavora. A forza di martelli, il ferro si riduce. A forza di scartelli, il marmo si lavora. L'amore tristarello da può ridurre a segno, da può capacitar, capacitar. Mi donne coro nuovo, né ferro né martello.
And we're talking about listening to music from the opera La Finta Giardiniera. And one thing I'm noticing, we have a lot of excerpts that we're playing today, and they're mostly arias.
Yes.
And when we think about some of the other operas that we're listening to in this series and at the Santa Fe Opera this summer, some of them really are about duet and ensemble. Mm. And so you can see the evolution of style over the course of the 18th and 19th
yes,
centuries.
Yes, absolutely. This was sort of structured into that recitative aria, but there are ensembles. Mozart's great ensembles typically come at the end of each act, and that's true of this opera, where they all come together and sing as a group with the chorus, and the whole thing ends that way too. So it always ends on a high note, and generally a note of chorus. So let's talk a little now about Count Belfiore, who is an aristocrat, of course, who got in a row with his girlfriend Violante and hit her so badly that he thought he was dead. So he ran off and got engaged to another woman called Araminda, who shows up here. And when he arrives at this estate, he doesn't know that his beloved, who is Sandrina slash Violante,
who he hit and left for dead,
is the gardener in the very estate where he is about to be betrothed to this new woman, Arminda. So when he arrives, again, this is a very tongue-in-cheek piece, he arrives telling the mayor of his great ancient nobility and how lucky, he implies, Arminda is to have him. Now, this is a man who's knocked around his girlfriend. We have very little respect for this count, but he insists that he has good genealogy and sings, "I have great estates, vassals, grandfathers who were marshals, sisters who were princesses, 3 queens, 6 countesses, 2 Roman consuls, and princes and other sovereigns are too many to be counted. But good grace, sir, you are laughing. You cannot see them." And he lists all of these. I mean, ridiculous. You would never do that. And again, it's Mozart poking fun at the aristocracy with their great genealogical lines. And this is the count, the tenor, of course, from La Finta Giardiniera.
Scipione, Sant'Acqua, Marco Aurelio, Marco Agrippa, Lucio Scevola e Cattone, inchinatevi, e quei due che vanno a spalla, con Tiberio e Carrapalla, con rispetto salutatevi, profondatevi, inchinatevi, a ciascun di qua di là, a ciascun di qua di là.
See what I mean? You just have to sit back and enjoy the music. It really doesn't matter what's going on in the text.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still important what's going on in the text to some extent, because there are love issues, which are always interesting. There are class issues. And what we're doing today is we're kind of listening to each of the characters sing, so we at least get to know them as characters. And as Desiree said, you know, you'll have to go to actually see what happens.
To unravel it all.
Yeah, yes, to unravel it all, or just to take it all in.
It all has a happy ending. Let's play now the a little piece from Ramiro's aria. Ramiro is the mezzo-soprano, as I said, not a castrato. And he is straight from the seria style, the older, more serious style of opera. This is also probably the only true character in the entire opera who is not wearing a mask. He is in love with Arminda. She can't be doing with him. He gets her in the end. But meantime, he goes through all of this rejected lover stuff. And he sings, he's told at one point by the mayor, "Well, get over it. You know, one love leaves, the next one comes in." And he responds by singing, "If one day the little bird escapes from its cage, it will not cheerfully fly around the hunter. Scarcely having escaped from an amorous adventure, the idea of another trap, how it makes me tremble." So let's hear this more serious style from Ramiro, the mezzo-soprano.
Ramiro's aria. And you said, Desiree, before this aria about this is the one person who's not wearing a mask. And it got me thinking about, I mean, masks is both a literal and a figurative idea. And
both apply.
And are they wearing actual masks on stage? I mean, can you sing when you have a mask on?
Well, that is a problem. There was a Ring version recently done, directed by a man who was an artist, painter first and director second, who had these enormous masks, full-face masks with voice boxes or something ridiculous for the singers, who all mutinied and said, we cannot sing through these things. We can't turn our heads, our voices can't, and we can't project. I mean, it was a nightmare. Now, typically, I'm not sure, they, in this, it's more figurative that they're wearing, they don't physically wear masks, though in Rigoletto, they do. It opens with that carnival mask, and you've seen those. They're very ornate, exotic, fabulous masks, but they sort of end at the nose. They're half-face masks, so they go from the nose up, and then they have feathers and gold and all sorts of stuff, but the mouths are free, so the singers can sing. So here, it's more of a figurative sense. It's a social convention that you, well, we do it today, you know. Someone asks you, how are you? You say, I'm fine. I mean, you might be dying, but I mean, the response, the instinctive response is, oh, everything's fine, unless it's someone you know, and then you maybe tell the truth. But we do that. I mean, we do it without thinking. Everything's good. Everything's fine. And actually, no, I've had a terrible day. So it's the same sort of thing that he's picked up on here, a very human little thing. And Mozart does this all the time. He picks up on very human little events and feelings, emotions that you don't think a lot about that are as relevant today as they were then. So we probably should hear from Sandrina, who is the gardener who's causing all this problem in the middle of everything. She also sings a straight. There's no comic aspect to her.
No, she's a false gardener, or she's a real gardener?
She is the pretend gardener.
She's the pretend gardener.
She is really the Duchess, okay, who is in love with this terrible count. So at this point, she sings of her unhappiness. And as you listen to this, for listeners out there who know The Marriage of Figaro, you'll hear already the Countess, the great Countess, who is the sadly badly treated Countess of The Marriage of Figaro in this role. This is where it came from. It's very elegiac. It's sad. She's expressing despair and fear. And later on, she is abandoned in the forest by jealous women where they say, let her play lady to the wolves. And she's frightened. And then oboes and bassoons and all that come in. But this character turns around. She stands by her guns, literally. She becomes heroic. She's a woman who comes out on top, actually, at the end of it, with the man she actually happens to love, which is a questionable decision, I suppose, given who he is. But
he's the one who knocked her down and left her for dead.
Yes, yes. And at one point, when he sees her in the garden, he says, oh, are you Violante? And she says, no, I'm Sandrina. And then the authorities, the police, arrive to arrest him because he is up for the murder of this woman. And at that point, she turns to him and she says, well, actually, I am Violante. I'm not dead. And she gives evidence on his behalf. And he's thrilled. He's found her. Everything's fine. But the moment the police leave, she reverts to Sandrina. She's so angry with him. And she says, no, I'm actually the gardener. I only said I was the Countess to let you off the hook. So there's all this sort of nonsense going on.
There is a kind of theme this opera season of women who love their abusers. I mean, that happened in Rigoletto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Salome gets her own back, however. If you think about it, balance it all out. She kills a guy first.
So let's hear from Sandrina.
So that is, if you like, the template for the the Countess and the Marriage of Figaro, of course. It's amazing if you know the two operas.
Say more about that.
Well, he's beginning to explore these different types of women. The aristocratic woman whose role in life is sort of set for her. Her marriages are arranged. She'll be married to someone she probably doesn't love. She'll have their children. It's a marriage of estates, of great names, of lands in those days. And the woman had very little say in what went on. She would simply bear the children. Then the husband would go off and have affairs with whomever he felt like, starting with his servants and, if possible, his mistress's servant. As happens in The Marriage of Figaro, he tries to make love to Susanna, who's one step ahead of him all the time, as is Despina in Così fan tutte. So Mozart is, this is on one hand, but then he balances these women out, the very sad and tragic Countess Orsandrina at this point, with the savvy servant girl. In some operas, they actually become friends, which is really jumping the class barrier, if you like. That would probably not have happened, but they collude together against the husband, the Count, who is treating women as if they are just property, both his wife and his mistresses. And in fact, there was a law at that time, le droit de seigneur, that stated that if the lord of the manor chose to sleep with the wife, with the fiancée of one of his servants the night before the wedding, i.e. take her virginity, he could, and got away with it.
That's right.
That happened in The Marriage of Figaro, where the Count says, no, I'm a liberated Count, I don't do that anymore. But he tries. Here that doesn't quite happen, because the focus is a little different. So you get here a sense from Sandrina of the sadness of her position. And then the next one is Arminda, who is the fiancée now, she thinks, of the Duke, who's really a prototype for Donna Elvira, an angry woman. She's warned the Count that if he plays around, she's going to not forgive him. So in her aria, she sings, I want to punish you, oh worthless man. I want to tear your heart out. I am afire with contempt, but the love that makes me sigh will not let me do it. Is this how, ungrateful man, you repay my love? Oh God, I am torn between anger and pity. So let's hear how she sounds. So this is Arminda's aria from the first act of La Finta Giardiniera, which the Santa Fe Opera will present this summer. So as I said, we're not going to do the whole of the story, but a couple of pointers that were after you've met all of the characters now. The seven characters in search of love. I think of it like a game of musical chairs. There's six chairs and seven people. One of them's going to be left out, and we'll find out in a moment who it is. But they all end up in the forest where Sandrina has been taken by these jealous women, and everybody ends up there. Now, this is a place where the masks come off, figuratively. They all find the wrong people. They're professing to love them, and only Ramiro, who saves the situation by coming in with a light, a candelabra probably, to reveal who is who. The Count and Sandrina have found each other, and they have this extraordinary scene where they think they are Greek gods. I mean, it goes that far. We have a parody of Greek gods in the early Baroque opera, and not one but two mad scenes. I mean, Mozart again is having fun here. Typically, it's the woman who goes mad. Women are fragile beings and go mad. In this case, the Count does too. So that all happens, and everyone else sort of stands back amazed. They end up, of course, going back to the mansion, back to their ordered lives. Everybody is sorted out with the right partners according to the right class, and it has a happy ending, which is exactly what had to happen in Mozart's time. He left it a little open-ended with Così fan tutte, where there are two couples who sort of fall in love with the wrong fiancés, and it's not quite clear how he intended the ending. With this, it's unequivocal. They end up with the right people. So the last excerpt I'd like to play is the final duet of Sandrina and the Count after they have returned to sanity after this Greek god theme. they try to separate. You know, I can't trust you, I don't love you, but the pull of love is too strong. And as they are drawing away from each other, they are gradually stepping back towards one another and end up in one another's arms to this gorgeous music.
There you have it. Sandrina and Belfiore are in love, and they end up in each other's arms, and that's how you sing when you end up in each other's arms in love. And I love what you wrote in Opera Unveiled, Desiree. The rest of the characters sort themselves out. Arminda decides Ramiro is better than no husband at all and ends up with him. Nardo, also known as Roberto, wins the lively servant Serpetta, while Podestà philosophically ends the opera saying, "I too will marry when I find another Sandrina." And that is basically, I mean, the class order is maintained. Mm. And as you said before, which I think is very interesting, it's all about to fall apart, really worldwide, Europe-wide, yeah. The class system.
The French Revolution followed not long after this, but he's sort of beginning to see that. Before we leave this, I would love to just tell people about the singers, the cast. We have an extraordinary cast, people who are well-known and loved here in Santa Fe. William Burden will sing Podestà. Heidi Stober will sing Sandrina. Arminda is the great Susanna Phillips, who is now in her sixth consecutive season at the Met.
Oh.
The The Count is the young Joel Prieto, who made a name for himself in this role at Glyndebourne just last year, I think. And Ramiro is sung by Cecilia Hall, the mezzo role. So that's something, there's no trauma in this opera. You're always safe with Mozart, and you know you're going to feel good at the end of the evening, because it's just, there's this joy and an effervescence and exuberance of this 18-year-old composer sharing his thoughts on life and love with through the medium of opera, which he so loved.
Desiree Mays, it's just great to have you on the Radio Cafe talking about the Santa Fe Opera. Thanks for being here.
It's always great fun to do this. I look forward to it every year.
Me too. We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet of the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number here in New Mexico is 505-986-5900.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.